One, two, three, four.
Future of Life Institute has been working on AI governance-related things for the last decade, and our mission is trying to steer very powerful technology away from large-scale harm and towards very beneficial outcomes. And large-scale harm, you could think about any kind of extreme risks from AI all the way to existential or extinction risk, like the worst kind of risk. And the benefits, you can think about any kind of large benefits that humans could achieve from technology all the way through to utopia, right? Like utopia is the biggest benefit you can get from technology. And historically, that has meant that we have focused on the impact of climate change, bio-related risks like pandemics. We're focused on nuclear security issues and increasingly the combination of AI with those other topics, but AI's impact more generally. I don't have any great answer to the question of what I could envision for the next 10 plus years. But if things go well, first of all, we're able to avoid these really bad downsides in terms of avoiding existential risk, extinction risks, mass surveillance, and really dystopian futures. We're able to avoid that very harmful side of AI or technology, and we can get some of the benefits. Obviously, people talk about some of the big things like solving cancer, solving climate change, making sure that we continue reducing poverty rates, increase equality in the whole world, increasing well-being and health. All of those things have improved with technology, but sometimes we see really bad negatives as well, which indicate that technology is not going to be net beneficial by itself, by default, but we have to somehow as a society direct it towards the beneficial outcomes. I am personally quite worried that technology, in my view, could be sometimes seen rather than enhancing our well-being or improving our lives, rather taking our attention, putting a lot of unnecessary disruption into our lives, directing our focus toward consuming more and more, away from spending time with our loved ones or learning, driven by curiosity.
Today, we take a closer look at the future of artificial intelligence and policies that determine its place in our societies. My guest is Risto Uck, head of EU policy and research at the Future of Life Institute in Brussels, and a philosopher and researcher at KU Leuven, where he studies the systemic risks posed by AI. He has worked with the World Economic Forum, the European Commission, and leading thinkers like Stuart Russell and Daniel Susskind. He also runs one of the most widely read newsletters on the EU AI Act. As this technology is transforming economies, politics, and human life itself, we'll talk about the promises and dangers of AI and how Europe is trying to regulate it and what it means to build safeguards for a technology that may be more powerful than anything we've seen before. Risto Uck, welcome to the Creative Process.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Risto, you're head of EU policy and research at the Future of Life Institute. What do you envisage for the future of life in the next 10, 20, 50 years? And just tell us about how you and your team are working to ensure we get a fair and equitable future where humans can flourish.
Yeah, Future of Life Institute has been working on AI governance-related things for the last decade, really. And our mission is trying to steer very powerful technology away from large-scale harm and towards very beneficial outcomes. And large-scale harm, you could think about any kind of extreme risks from AI all the way to existential or extinction risk, like the worst kind of risk. And the benefits, you can think about any kind of large benefits that humans could achieve from technology all the way through to utopia, right? Like utopia is the biggest benefit you can get from technology. And historically, that has meant that we have focused on climate change, for example, the impact of climate change, bio-related risks like pandemics. We're focused on nuclear security issues and increasingly the combination of AI with those other topics, but AI's impact more generally. And I think I don't have any great answer to the question of what I could envision for the next 10 plus years. But if things go well, first of all, we're able to avoid these really bad downsides in terms of avoiding existential risk, extinction risks, mass surveillance, and really dystopian futures. We're able to avoid that very harmful side of AI or technology, and we can get some of the benefits. Obviously, people talk about some of the big things like solving cancer, solving climate change, making sure that we continue reducing poverty rates, increase equality in the whole world, just increasing well-being and health numbers a lot. We have been able to achieve a lot of success as a society in terms of all of those things. I think people have become more educated, people have become more healthy, more prosperous. All of those things have improved with technology, but sometimes we see really bad negatives as well, which indicate that technology is not going to be net beneficial by itself by default, but we have to somehow as a society direct it towards the beneficial outcomes. So for example, people are concerned about mental health among teenagers from social media consumption, for example. People are concerned about obesity rates. People are worried about the numbers of cancer rates. Even though we've achieved a lot of success in that, it's a massive issue. Cardiovascular disease, tobacco, whatever. Like, we have so many big issues that we could make a lot of progress on, and technology could help with that. AI could help with that. But that's not guaranteed to happen, because I think for the last 10 plus years or so, I am personally quite worried that technology, in my view, could be sometimes seen, rather than enhancing our well-being or improving our lives, rather taking our attention, putting a lot of unnecessary disruption into our lives, directing our focus toward consuming more and more, away from spending time with our loved ones or learning, driven by curiosity. I'm quite worried about the impact of social media. I'm quite worried about how some of these other values, rather than increasing welfare, increasing well-being, are influencing technological developments. So yeah, that's kind of, in a nutshell, some of my thoughts.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, everyone, of course, quotes the possibility of finding novel health cures to cancer and these ailments. But of course, if we can't flourish in other ways, if it takes our jobs and we're no longer seen as valuable, as you say, this does affect our mental health. You know, we don't have that kind of pride in work and communities, and it affects the foods we eat. I know that physical health, we were discussing this a little bit before, that's really something that's important for you that you've learned from this. You don't come from a technological background. I mean, philosophy was your aim before you trained it upon this, I think, one of the most crucial issues of our time. So the benefits seem like they come with a lot of challenges. And that's why governance is really important, and making sure we implement the regulations and the guardrails that we put in place, which is another big obstacle. But just tell us a little bit about your background. What brought you first to philosophy, and then this element of concern for the impacts of technology on society?
Yeah, for sure. In my primary school, in my early education, I was very interested in learning. I was a great student. I competed in math Olympiads. I was, you know, one of the top students. I was really interested in learning in all kinds of fields. After my sixth grade, I went to study in one of the top schools in Estonia. And there, really, something changed. I became much less interested in learning. For some reason, the education had quite a negative impact on me in terms of my curiosity and my interest in understanding things. Maybe it was just too much. The learning was perhaps too demanding. I was in a math and science class, so perhaps the dose was too large. It was just too much studying too rigorously. That was one thing. Perhaps another thing was that I felt that I was forced to learn something and I didn't have enough space to study things on my own. And even up until high school, I didn't really spent that much effort on studying. I didn't care very much about it. And so my choice of university degree after high school was completely random. I just chose, you know, business and economics randomly without making any conscious decision that this is the best thing to do. And very soon I realized that was a mistake, because it just was a continuation of the same experience I had in my high school, which was kind of rote memorization, just trying to remember everything, finishing those exams. I felt I wasn't actually learning anything. And I actually, back then, when I decided to drop out of university, I wrote a blog post titled "Why I Dropped Out of University." And this turned out to be extremely popular as a blog post. It was read by, you know, over 50,000 Estonians. Estonia is very small. We have like 1 million people. At some point, it might have even been like almost 10% of Estonia had read my blog post. And even to this day, like over a decade later, I sometimes get emails from people telling me that they were so grateful for this blog post, because they also felt that they were pressured by society to just choose random university degrees, even if they had not reflected upon it very much. Some of them dropped out or just felt that they could take more time to reflect what they want to study and what they want to do with their lives. So they felt grateful for that. But in any case, I dropped out. I actually pursued my earlier passion as a career, which was I became a personal trainer. For over 5 years, I pursued a career in basic health and fitness and nutrition, trying to help people improve their lives through training, through their nutrition, through lifestyle habits. I helped them lose fat, improve their body composition, make themselves healthier. So I pursued this as a career. My approach was really somewhat different from some other personal trainers because I spent a lot of time reading scientific evidence about what to do, how to train well, how to eat well. And so I was quite evidence-based, scientifically minded. And I also pursued what was called motivational interviewing, which was basically instead of telling my clients, hey, you should eat 5 pieces of fruits and vegetables per day. Instead, I would ask them questions and they would reach the conclusion of what they should be doing with their time. And so sometimes they might come up with the idea that, hey, I should like eat more fruits and vegetables, and I would help them figure that out rather than telling them you should do this, because it's just much more likely that a person will continue practicing certain habits if they themselves come up with those habits in the first place. So that was my approach. But eventually, I just felt compelled by some arguments that I wasn't doing enough to make a difference in the world, to change the world and having an impact. Because I asked myself this question, what if I didn't take on these clients and if I didn't train them, I didn't support them in terms of nutrition, what would happen in their lives otherwise? And I reached the conclusion that oftentimes these same clients would find some other trainers. And maybe I would think that I'm better than some other trainers because I have a different focus and different approach or whatever. But I couldn't really persuade myself that I would be so much better than others, because just helping people lose weight, for example, is just extremely hard. There is scientific evidence that when people lose a substantial amount of body weight, they most of them regain that within the next 2 years, like 90% or more people regain that. So it's just extremely hard as a problem, regardless of how good you are as a trainer. And now we're seeing that maybe some other drugs are helping us more than trainers can help us, like Ozempic and different kinds of weight loss drugs, right? They are maybe having an even bigger impact. But anyway, I just lost my drive working in that career because I just couldn't see how I could have a very meaningful difference, counterfactual difference in the world. So I started looking for other things to do. And I was wondering about whether I could work in animal welfare, improving the lives of animals. A lot of animals live in really bad conditions in factory farms. So I was thinking about that. I was thinking about global poverty, climate change, AI, all of the different topics. And I tested my fit in those areas. I started projects, whether it was related to research or running a nonprofit or organizing events. I tried all kinds of things and tried to figure out what types of tasks and what types of issues I most care about, most interested in. And I ended up, for some time, I worked as a science editor for Estonian Public Broadcasting. And there I was able to cover a lot of different topics, including AI-related issues, and really found AI very pressing and very interesting and felt I could contribute. I participated in the AI safety camp, which was a research camp where people worked on AI safety issues, tried to pursue some research projects. I ended up working on a project there about the AI policymaking process. How could we take learnings from general political science policymaking process, and how could we take those and transfer those to AI policymaking, and what could we learn from that? And my paper got accepted in a peer-reviewed journal, and quite many people started reading it, and I found it quite encouraging that I could contribute. And then I started looking into going back to university. I decided to go for undergraduate to do philosophy and economics because I thought philosophy would help me think critically about how to live my life, how should society live, how should we organize political institutions, like these really big questions. How should we think critically, thinking about the epistemology, trying to understand what knowledge is, how do we gain knowledge, thinking about these questions. And economics would be about ultimately how to allocate scarce resources to achieve certain ends. And I just thought that philosophy together with economics would be a really nice combination, because philosophy would give me better answers for what should we do as a society, what should I do as an individual, And economics would help me think better about how to allocate those resources to achieve those ends that philosophy kind of gives me.
Yeah, I want to come in there because I think that's so fascinating. And I think that you're unique in terms of the AI researchers and policymakers and other thinkers that we've had on, in that you come from this personal health and well-being as a foundation. And I think that many people might think that there isn't a through line, but I think in some ways, one of the many crucial questions about AI is that in our race for efficiency and, you know, domination, that we forget the human-centered aspect. We forget that there's artificial intelligence, there's embodied intelligence, there's adaptive intelligence, there's a lot of different, there's artistic intelligence, intuitive intelligence, and there's holistic learning. And I think that a real risk is that when we start to, from AI's perspective, if we're going to humanize it, it sees everything as a data set. But with holistic learning, there's the whole of life and the experience of walking this earth and breathing the air and all these other things that aren't necessarily measured. And so I think it's really important and perhaps imparts a kind of empathy to your research that is important. A lot of people maybe haven't had the chance to read the EU AI Act. And I think AI seems like a great choice for you, as you say, because it touches every element of society. There's no aspect, there's no job, there's nothing that's not going to be touched or isn't already being touched by AI. But just to give us an overview of what the EU AI Act has set out to do, and how is it, you know, as we move towards implementation, how is it doing that? Just to give it in a kind of snapshot, the kind of safeguards that are being put in place.
Sure. So the EU Act is a law that the European Union recently passed back in 2024. It's literally a process of multiple years of negotiation between different EU institutions. The EU is somewhat complex of an apparatus. There's many different member states that are involved in the process. And through this negotiation process, this law was passed. The law essentially creates different categories of risk classification. So there are certain kinds of AI systems that are entirely banned, that are not allowed on the EU market. And those are very manipulative AI systems and target vulnerable people and so on. There aren't many AI systems that are not banned or prohibited. They just, the companies, the providers, just have to implement certain safeguards. So another category is called high-risk AI systems. So here again, certain use cases are considered high-risk. So there are things like the use of AI in critical infrastructure, the use of AI in certain educational settings, deciding who gets admitted to a university program, and AI in recruitment, deciding who gets a job, those kinds of high risk. And the providers of those kinds of AI systems have to abide by certain rules, ensuring that there's enough human oversight over these systems, to making sure that good data governance principles have been implementing, to making sure that AI systems in these use cases are accurate, that have good cybersecurity practices implemented, things like that. Then there's another category which is called AI transparency, which basically only certain requirements here. For example, when there's a chance that the humans don't know that they're interacting with an AI system, then the provider has to be transparent about that they are using AI and not speaking with a human being. Or when AI is generating, manipulating certain content, whether it's text or video or images, being transparent about that text being AI generated. But usually those requirements are quite narrow, in the sense that if you use AI for slightly modifying text, you don't probably have to disclose anything. But if you're using a fully AI generated content, then you have to disclose it, for example, as a journalist and some other professionals. So quite narrow requirements there. And then final category would be systemic risk, which is basically when general purpose AI that is highly capable is used, then there is potential that risks to whole societies rather than a single individual. The region's national security or health or safety is at stake. But the whole idea behind this regulation, why this regulation was introduced in the first place, is to ensure that there is enough uptake in the European Union of AI. The people in the European Union, they want technology to serve their interests. They don't want technology to be harmful. And so they might be somewhat skeptical of technology. They might be hesitant to use it. They might be conservative, perhaps more conservative than US citizens are. So they need some kind of assurance that they can trust this technology. Their thinking is that you introduce a law, you make sure that everybody, all the businesses in the whole European Union in the so-called single market, they abide by the same rules, and that increases, enhances this uptake of the technology, and we can get some of the benefits and remove the downsides or avoid the downsides, or at least prevent them to some extent, make sure that your health, safety, fundamental rights are protected. So overall, we benefit societies in terms of getting a lot of upsides from technological uptake and reducing the downsides from all of these risks that they could pose.
Yeah, and it's a bit of a tightrope act because on the other hand, we're constantly hearing from EU leaders that they don't want to be left behind in the great AI race and that it offers so much promise if we can get ahead and we can dominate. So on the one hand, they want to regulate. At the other hand, we hear that over-regulating, we could risk losing out on the benefits. I believe in regulation, but it's just really how it's done. And it's often the black box. So we don't get to really see the way AI is developing. And then at the same time, with regulation, we want to be safe from AI and its potential harm and bad actors. At the same time, those of us who are also skeptical of surveillance capitalism and state surveillance want to make sure that those regulations aren't also surveilling us, aren't further scraping us or watching us in ways that we aren't authorizing. So AI is watching us, scraping our data, scraping our creativity, and at the other hand, having too heavy a hand by regulatory bodies. It could be doing it in a different way, controlling us in another way. Although I'm very pro-regulation and guardrails. I mean, what are your views on that?
Yeah, you touch upon many different angles and make good points. So I generally don't like the dichotomy between innovation and regulation. Ultimately, I think regulation is about setting up rules and incentives and the incentives of the whole environment, the economic, societal environment. That's what regulation is about. Innovation, in my view, I like to think of innovation not as just economic activity by itself, but more like economic activity that leads to certain kinds of benefits for humans. So some type of economic activity, actually, we would consider not innovation if it doesn't lead to improved welfare or well-being of citizens. And that's where regulation can come in. The market might not by itself, without any kind of government involvement, any kind of soft laws, hard laws, some kind of regulatory incentives, might not by itself take care of those issues. So I don't see there as necessarily a big conflict between that. If you introduce more regulation, you get less innovation. But of course, the way you design regulation does matter because we know, for example, from certain kind of regulatory environments and regulatory experiments that some companies might try to take advantage of regulations and they might want to game regulation and they not consider the spirit of regulation, but look how they can comply with the regulation on paper. So for example, one idea is some labor law introduced in France where when a company had fewer than 50 employees, no regulation kicked in, no extra burdens kicked in. More than 50 employees had certain labor obligations, labor requirements. And what has happened in France is a lot of companies have tried to stay under 50. So you have many companies that are like 49 employees, 48, under 50. And this is not necessarily the spirit of the law. The goal wasn't of the law to have companies be under 50 employees. The goal was such that probably policymakers thought that if you have more than 50 employees, then you have more resources, then you are able to take care of your employees better, perhaps. But yeah, it's quite clear that in some cases, it can happen that some kind of spirit of the law is gamed and there are loopholes and actually turns out that the regulation doesn't have that kind of impact that you initially want it to be.
Exactly. And of course that we know that this has been one argument that regulation is something that only the largest tech companies or the largest legacy tech companies could afford to comply because there is just another level of work, even though they, you know, startup companies might really want to comply. It just is an added expense that they might not have in their startup phase. And just to that point of needing regulation and not wanting to be guinea pigs for this new technology that even its AI's designers say they don't know how it works, you know, on the point of social media, we've been the guinea pigs of this for the last 25, 30 years, and it's managed to reduce debate to an us versus them mentality. And right now, look at today, there's a lot of unrest around the world, from climate change to unstable politics. 3 days ago, virtually trillionaire Elon Musk told far-right political activist Tommy Robinson and 150,000 of his followers that the UK needs revolutionary government change. So we see so much power in the hands of the large tech companies who are lobbying now for less or no regulation. Regulations in the US have been rolled back, and we kind of have a runaway train situation, at least in the US, where they just don't want to be monitored. So this is a very, I think, a dangerous time. Elon Musk is saying civil war is inevitable, and effectively he's using the X platform to stir unrest. Last week, he also had the far right in the US, since the killing of Charlie Kirk, now publicly demanding retribution. So these are the kind of things that can really be turbocharged by AI, this unrest. And that's where we are in today, of what social media is doing to persuade and influence society. And social media, of course, heavily powered by AI. So what do you think the effect of AI is going to have in the next 30 years, considering it's far more powerful tool to persuade and influence outcomes and just hold sway over the masses?
Some people make the case that AI oftentimes doesn't bring any novel risks per se, but it can just amplify existing risks and make them more prevalent, distribute them more easily. So in the case of misinformation or polarization issues, those risks have already existed, right? But AI has potential to amplify those risks and make them worse. So last year, a lot of people thought that we would see many incidents related to AI being used in elections or misused in elections, because there were many elections all over the world. But some scholars have indicated that we didn't find much evidence of that being the case. And they wondered why, because if you look at certain experiments or tests, you can actually find that AI is already extremely good at persuasive abilities. Deepfakes are very hard to distinguish from real things. Sometimes it's very hard to know whether AI is involved in something or not. Interestingly, we know that the capabilities are there. For some reason, we either don't have the evidence that they are having such a strong impact yet, or for some reason, they are not distributed or used as much still. Maybe they're too costly, or the knowledge isn't there yet, or something like that. But the capabilities are definitely increasing a lot. So one can wonder whether, if the impact has not been so severe, it could still be in the future.
Yeah, but that's also depends on how you're defining AI, because certain AI, I mean, social media has been using AI in terms of, there's not a bunch of people just behind desks, yes, at Facebook, et cetera. So the algorithm is fueled by AI and what enters your news feed. And maybe they're talking about how you're profiled and things, but there's crude AI and there's sophisticated AI. So maybe they're not talking about deep fakes, impersonating someone, or fake news per se, but the social media is full of fake news. And it also feeds you all kind of rage to engage, all these kind of stories. So if you're on the fence about who you're going to vote for or whatever, you could be fed, you can fall down the rabbit hole. And there is an AI at play in that. And it's not a bunch of workers. We know it's not a bunch of individual people just at Facebook or X.
Definitely.
I do think it is there and it has done it for past elections. And we're just lucky if it isn't in the deeper, bigger lies that are just so, you know, faked. I just think
Nowadays, when you go on Twitter or X and you open your feed, it is just full of very negative content, very bad content, a lot of conspiracy theories, hostile, aggressive content. And surely that is having an impact on people. That's very clear. That's the case. Even if we don't necessarily have knocked down scientific evidence yet for that, you hear so many stories from people, anecdotal evidence of how much doom scrolling they go through, how much these social media platforms are having an impact on their thinking, their attention. They are sometimes actually changing their behaviors based on that contact in their feed. So for sure, it's having that impact, but we don't necessarily have solid evidence scientifically, but those kinds of things take time to study.
As a PhD student in philosophy, I find it really difficult not to be taken in by the existential threat rhetoric that surrounds AI. Like Risto Uk notes, AI is rapidly transforming how we read, how we write, how we learn, and perhaps most importantly, how we engage with information in the public sphere. The consequences for philosophical practice seem damning, and for democracy even more so. Indeed, philosophers or not, we're all much too familiar with the laundry list of risks that bookend any discussion about the rise of AI. But while I think it's important to acknowledge these risks, it is equally important to evaluate them in a broader social and historical context. Put differently, we must ask ourselves, are there any historical precedents for the risks we attribute to AI? And if so, how might these precedents offer tools and strategies for navigating our encounters with AI today? As Uk points out, there's a great deal of research suggesting that AI doesn't create new problems out of a vacuum, but amplifies already existing ones. Two such problems he highlights are the spread of misinformation and the rise of political polarization. For the purposes of this interlude, let's focus on the first of these, misinformation. Those of you who, like me, can recall a time before chatbots won't find it particularly earth-shattering when I say that misinformation predates the rise of AI. Backtracking to the early 2000s, we see it at play in all sorts of Y2K digital detritus. Think tabloids, spam mail, and chain letters. But let's go a step further. Let's time travel to ancient Rome. Enter Cicero, a classical skeptic philosopher who held that there's no reliable way to differentiate between truth and falsity. False impressions can strike us just as convincingly as true ones. Now, fast forward to Descartes, who held that all our sensory perceptions are prone to error. Our eyes deceive us with illusions, our ears with echoes, our minds with dreams. In a crude sense, then, both of these philosophers suggest that a certain degree of quote-unquote misinformation is inevitable, not because something is trying to trick us, but because susceptibility to error is embedded in the very cognitive and perceptual vehicles through which we engage with the world. Their solution? Well, Cicero proposes something he calls withholding assent, an epistemic attitude in which we resist the urge to invest our impressions with absolute truth, while still acting on those that seem most plausible. Applied to our current context, Cicero's model of withholding assent reminds us that we aren't simply passive recipients of AI-driven misinformation. To withhold is to pause, to doubt, to resist the impulse to assent too quickly. In other words, it is a way of reclaiming and reasserting our epistemic agency in the face of persuasive but unreliable appearances. Kant, centuries later, gestures towards something similar when he ties human dignity to the capacity for refusal, the ability to pause, defer, or resist acting on immediate desires. In confronting AI, we enact a kind of comparable restraint, holding back from instant assent and preserving the space to judge and decide for ourselves. Now, I want to emphasize that withholding assent doesn't mean pathological distrust, nor does it have to result in the sort of political disengagement that distrust so often produces. Quite the opposite. Engaging in democratic discourse requires that we doubt ourselves and our political convictions. By doing so, we remain open to others' perspectives, responsive to disagreement, and flexible enough to revise our views. In short, we lay the groundwork for continued collaborative inquiry. All this raises an interesting question. If by bringing about conditions of epistemic uncertainty, AI forces us to take up productive kinds of doubt, is it really all that bad? Of course, I would hesitate to call the global circulation of AI-generated misinformation a good thing, but by magnifying the uncertainty that Cicero and Descartes once treated as inescapable, it may at least remind us of the intellectual virtues best suited for both philosophy and democracy: self-reflection, flexibility, and the courage to withhold assent. So maybe AI isn't the boogeyman after all, but a provocation to practice philosophy and democracy more fully. As Socrates put it, the first step towards wisdom is learning to doubt oneself. If that's true, then AI might be the best gadfly we've got. And now, back to the interview.
And the other thing is, through whether we believe the disinformation or the fake news, what it can do is, when we're constantly fed with this negativity, or where we see, oh my gosh, it's corrupt on this side, it's corrupt on the other side, it convinces people not to believe anything. So you could say that one party is more truthful or is delivering its aims and its promises, but because there's enough corruption or fake news or disinformation out there, that it just makes people distrust the whole system, so they don't vote. And that's another way of making people passive and more easy to control. So, and we know that that's how fascism has worked in the past, and it leads people to these splinter groups. So yeah, I do feel it is having an effect. Now, one area I want to ask you about is how it's impacting creatives. Traditionally, artists and writers and filmmakers already have a very precarious livelihood. We have to put in a lot of work for a project that might not get done. We don't have the guarantee of a paycheck. We're a very competitive market already. And so many have been scraped in some way or another. And it's really unfair. I feel that people who've put in the 10,000 plus hours, who have a kind of mastery of their medium, AI is not necessarily going to help them. Obviously, there's some shortcuts, some efficiencies, but it doesn't necessarily make them better artists. They can use it selectively. But for people more amateur who haven't put those hours in and maybe they want to do things quicker, they can create work that's of a superior level. They don't have the mastery yet. So it elevates them. And I think it actually brings down if an artist who has an individual voice depends upon it. So in general, as I've spoken to a lot of these masters in their medium, creative experts, they don't want to use it. They see some benefits, but they're very selective and they have a pride in their work. However, I can see over time that they might feel they have to use it because others who haven't put in the hours are using AI and they're getting results faster, so that the master artists, people who've really spent a lifetime at this, just can't produce as quick as that. And then they feel they have to get on the AI treadmill just to keep up with the market forces. So I just wonder your views are on the future of creativity in Europe, and how do we going forward, if we're not Taylor Swift, if we're not like some massive artist, how do we protect ourselves and create and nourish the artists of tomorrow? Those guys, the Taylor Swifts and the big artists, are going to be fine, but they themselves had to be incubated. They had to take time to arrive at that artistry. And I just see that kind of disappearing if we're just scraped data sets.
Yeah, so much there. And then you've already shared so many useful and interesting points for listeners. I would just kind of express my own quick sentiments regarding AI generated art and images and photos and whatnot. And I personally benefit a lot from large language models regarding text generation. They can be very useful in terms of summarizing things, helping analyze data, helping paraphrase something. They can be very useful for those kind of things. And for example, I personally tend to like Apple Intelligence, which has certain kinds of small features that are not very disruptive to one's thinking, but are just like small tinkerings at the margins. For example, you can write your own piece of text and then you can ask it to rewrite, and then it's just some kind of paraphrasing of that. Or you can ask it to proofread your text and it can proofread it. And so these kind of small features are very useful and they're not highly disruptive to one's thinking. But whenever I see AI-generated images or video or photos, I have a really, you know, sort of, I would say, even like disgust feeling towards those. Like oftentimes they're not very nice. They're not very enjoyable. I don't like those images. People tend to still use them. A lot of people use AI-generated images and just put them as covers to their content. I just personally don't like them. I'm sure it's possible to use AI to generate images that are more authentic and more interesting. You can ask AI to produce certain kind of images or photos or art in the voice of some artist. And so it will create that kind of image rather than this clearly very modern AI generated piece of art. But yeah, a lot of people don't do that. A lot of people use this. You just like immediately disgusted by that image and you don't want to see it ever again. And then I just go to, for example, Unsplash, which is a database that where you can use, you know, real photos by real people. So instead I go there and use photos from them. One thing that I do feel when I have my daughter who's 6 years old, and I read children's books to her in the evening. And oftentimes I find myself checking the illustrations and wondering, like reading on the cover that like two people were illustrators to those books and they drew those images and photos and whatnot. And I wondered to myself, I'm pretty sure that AI could like do those images very fast or like out of job very easily. And that's like, feels quite sad that that's the case. But I also know that, yeah, I'm pretty certain that AI is easily able to do those things already. So yeah, that's kind of in many ways like a very sad state of the world. Of course, one could immediately respond, well, yes, but if we responded to this situation properly as a society, then maybe it's not such a bad thing. So suppose that overall we produced a lot of productivity in the world and everybody overall became richer. And we distributed the wealth from a few to as many as possible. And so everybody became richer. then it would be great if those illustrators could continue drawing and creating art and so on, but just for its own sake, not for the sake of earning a living, but for being able to produce it, because it's just nice. They like to do it, and others like to consume art, not because there's an economic need for it. But unfortunately, the world isn't necessarily so nice and clean and orderly and rational that we just automate away a certain job and then, but ensure that people still have a livelihood and they have the resources and everything. Even if new jobs are created, people could learn to take on those jobs. Those other jobs could be just much more difficult. They might not be able to train themselves to join those. Like, imagine in the past, there were a lot of truck drivers who could have potentially lost their jobs. And people were like, but those truck drivers can become programmers. It's all good. But then could you imagine those truck drivers, millions of them, just becoming programmers? Yes, now the situation is even different, right?
If you want to become a plumber, I think you're probably safe for the future. And maybe chefs too, though I'm not entirely sure. I've seen some robotic chefs already. But what's interesting, I think, I know you've worked with economist and writer Daniel Susskind. And when I interviewed him, he's obviously skeptical about AI and is advocating for safeguards. But like you, he also mentioned his children and reading to them bedtime stories and using AI to help create those bedtime stories. His children even come up with their own prompts, which he says encourages them to be inventive and creative at a young age, perhaps before they could write those stories on their own. So it's a kind of co-creation, I think. The kids have an idea, they collaborate with AI, and together they make their bedtime story. So I think in that way, that's a kind of wonderful way of using AI to nurture creativity and imaginative thinking. And I think I'm really open to that kind of collaboration. On another note regarding artists, I would love to see a universal basic income for them. Artists obviously play a crucial role in society, showing us new ways of seeing and thinking. And yet many artists live hand to mouth, and artists' work has been scraped without their consent. Well, we've all been scraped, but particularly their work has been scraped. And they have a deep passion for life and a desire to contribute to the greater good, whether it's culture, society, or even addressing issues like climate change. Unfortunately, they're becoming increasingly marginalized and seen as wishful thinkers rather than voices of concern. So, of course, it's easier to support the megastars. They're already doing well economically. But for the majority of artists, how would such a system work in practice? I'd really like to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's good reasons to be skeptical of the feasibility of universal basic income or wage, because even things like companies, corporations paying enough taxes has just been an uphill battle. Corporations do everything to avoid paying taxes. There was a study that I read that indicated $600 billion in terms of taxes avoided each year by some of the biggest companies. Many of them moved their headquarters or their corporations to certain tax havens so that they avoid paying taxes. Even thing like global minimum tax that has been negotiated for many decades, that's been extremely challenging to achieve. So yeah, I think it's very reasonable to be skeptical of a universal basic income to be a thing. And also it would be extremely expensive. So many would just complain over that. Even things like paying parents certain amount every month has been extremely challenging, for example, in the US. They look up to the EU for having achieved these kinds of social security nets and things like that. And in the US, that's been very challenging. Over, I think, COVID period, some of those things were achieved. But then when the pandemic was over, then again, none of those payments were made again. So I just think generally, these kinds of things are just very hard to achieve. So I don't know necessarily like what would be good solutions. I think some people have been working on a possible kind of licenses for creatives so that AI developers, AI companies wouldn't just randomly, without asking for permission, train AI models on a lot of great content that artists have produced, but they would rather pay for a license and they would be able to use that content to train their AI models. Then that's been something that is being proposed. And I think some artists at least have liked that. But generally, I think this whole space around AI copyright and how to use artist materials, it's just very challenging. And there are many lawsuits currently ongoing and many challenges around it.
Yeah, of course. And honestly, everyone likes things that are free, but the apps and the tools that I actually pay for are the ones that I really use. So usually paid options are geared towards professionals, while most casual users stick with the free versions because they don't see them as essential unless the free model severely limits functionality. So if a tool is too slow or inefficient, I can see people upgrading to a paid version, which often involves licensing. But we haven't really seen that kind of respect or structure from the major players in AI. But historically, companies like Google invested heavily in research and model training, but the landscape has become so different now. So how do you see the EU AI Act shaping things, especially with Europe taking the lead in AI governance? And how do you think it might ripple out to the US and China? And how does it compare to what those regions are doing? And do you think it could encourage a more responsible global approach to AI governance?
Yeah, there is a concept called the process effect, which is the idea that when the EU regulates some technology or some other area, that has an impact on the rest of the world in terms of either companies changing their practices towards what the European Union asks for, or even governments picking up a similar type of regulation in their own jurisdiction. That is called like two types of process effect. And right now in the current geopolitical situation, I think there is some quite strong skepticism towards the process effect in terms of having an impact, for example, on the US government copying something that the EU does. There's quite strong skepticism of that. But I think I'm not so skeptical of the whole concept because, for example, I recently did a research visit at Stanford Digital Economy Lab. And so I stayed in California for several months and I met with many AI companies there. And I saw firsthand how much they are paying attention to the EU, the EU AI Act in particular, and how they're changing their risk assessment, risk mitigation practices internally to comply with the EU AI Act. You saw that with the EU Code of Practice that was just finalized in July this year, which are essentially guidelines to help companies comply with the EU AI Act, general purpose AI rules. And most big technology companies in the US signed the Code of Practice saying that they would like to use it to comply with the EU AI Act. So I think so far it looks like there's quite a lot of process effects in terms of companies changing their practices. Because the EU market is just very significant, very important market for these tech companies. I think OpenAI has more than 50 million users, apparently, in the EU. And for many companies, the EU market might be more attractive even than the US market, because maybe the US market is already taken by some other competitors. So maybe the EU market looks more attractive because you can enter a new market and make a lot of new business there. That's the first thing to say. And second thing, actually, there does seem to be some influence that the EU AI Act is also having on other countries in the world in terms of governments introducing legislation. For example, South Korea came out with their own AI law. I think Vietnam recently came out with one. I think Brazil is finalizing their AI law. And so I think different states in the US are considering, have implemented, like Colorado has a law, and some other states, California, New York, other ones are considering other laws. Some of them, I won't say that any of them copy the EU AI Act exactly the way the EU AI Act is. It's not true. They cherry pick certain things. Maybe they are inspired by other things. Maybe they just follow the EU AI Act's conversation and negotiation and kind of come up with something new based on that discussion. But the EU is definitely having a huge impact on all of these other countries in the world developing their own regulation based on this. You just have to pay attention to the EU because it's the first comprehensive AI regulation in the world. And it would be silly for you not to take advantage of those learnings and that experiment that the EU is going through, even if you decide to cherry pick something or choose completely something new. And also we shouldn't discount what China is doing because China came out with AI related laws probably even earlier than the EU, even though they didn't come up with a very comprehensive one like the EU Act, but they came out with other ones even earlier and they continue working on that quite a lot.
Well, with China, their government regulation, in general, when they act on something, they can implement it at scale quickly. You mentioned a few things I do want to ask you. So you mentioned Stanford, who we co-produce a podcast with and work different episodes. And also you are at KU Leuven, a university where we brought our creative process exhibition there in collaboration with the European Conference for the Humanities. So education is forefront of our mind. You know, what implications are there for the future of education with AI, how is it affecting our critical thinking, our ability? You talked about coming up as someone who was invested in fitness, all these things that take effort. Machines can do stuff for us, but we have to put the personal effort, and there's that personal satisfaction of when you do things yourself. So, you know, what should we be really thinking about when the future of education and AI?
Yeah, great question. So I'm quite worried about the impact of AI on education and definitely think that we should reflect on it a lot. I recently saw on social media a really interesting example of somebody describing their experience using AI. It was an undergraduate student at UC Berkeley, and that person said that, "I just deleted my ChatGPT, Perplexity, and Claude account. Ever since I started using these tools, I've become less curious about the world. I became obsessed with generating outputs rather than making mistakes and growing." And I found this super interesting because I tend to also feel this way. Of course, not everybody has the same type of experience. Like, some might feel that AI allows them to pursue some new questions that they have and actually makes them more curious. But I just start from the fact that humans, for lack of a better word, are lazy. You know, they just want to choose something that is easier rather than harder. Whenever you have a path of least resistance, something that doesn't take much effort, you want to choose that. Like, I see that from my child. Like, she wants to do less work. That's like human nature, right? So if you have the option to ask ChatGPT or some other AI system a question and they immediately answer it very thoroughly, very well, like, why should you work any harder? Like, you just ask that question, you get an answer. But I think we as a society, we should take a step backwards and think about what do we actually want from education. Maybe we don't want it to be very simple for students just to ask questions and get immediate answers, or ask an AI system to solve a mathematical problem very easily. Maybe instead we want to use AI systems to amplify their curiosity, amplify their thinking. So, for example, instead of giving you a straight answer, it will help you think the issue through. It will ask you, hey, why do you think this way? Like, where would you search for this information? Maybe they ask additional questions to make you really think very hard and figure out a solution to the issue yourself, rather than giving you an answer without you working hard at all. And there are examples of these kinds of AI systems potentially being developed. For example, a few months ago, I saw this AI company Anthropic. They were experimenting with basically an AI system that guides students through problem solving without providing them immediate answers. And so that could be an option, like pursuing those kinds of educational tools. I earlier mentioned that Apple Intelligence has these nice features that help amplify some of your own thinking and writing abilities. Rather than drafting an essay from scratch, for example, you have to write it on your own, and then you could ask it to rephrase or rewrite something or proofread something and so on. So you can kind of improve upon your writing rather than it would do that for you on its own. So I think those kinds of AI systems have potential to be very useful in educational context. But I think that by default, students, society just want something that gives them immediate answers and you don't have to do much work at all. And I'm really concerned about that because there's already some early empirical evidence indicating that people reduce cognitive effort when they're using AI systems. They just are cognitively more lazy. Their critical thinking can go down. Maybe there are some potential benefits in terms of switching the types of skills and thinking that you do away from kind of object level toward more meta cognitive things. So like how to come up with the right question, how to write a good prompt, like some other kinds of ways of thinking. Maybe that's a positive side of it, but I think the negatives seem to outweigh the positives to me. Like a lot of the thinking you just delegate to AI systems. And I think it's fine to delegate certain kind of thinking to AI, like maybe it's okay to delegate, proofreading to AI or some kind of task like that. But I don't know if you want to delegate critical thinking, making judgments, our ability to solve problems. Like those are really important skills that make us human. I don't think we want to delegate those too easily to AI systems. We really need to reflect on it.
I think it really comes to a question of we should develop our own intelligence before we develop a relationship with artificial intelligence. We have an intuitive intelligence. We have developed our foundation. I think that a lot of people who I've spoken to have a really solid foundation and body of work where it really came out of the fruits of their own mind and perhaps the fruits of the minds of their collaborators. And I'm not so much for a co-creation or maybe in a kind of a small level feedback. Say, oh, here's a second pair of eyes. And then you started to develop this theme here, but you didn't finish that thought. Because sometimes we might, when we're writing something or producing, we might miss something. And maybe an AI, because it can scan it all without fatigue, it could give that kind of feedback. And kind of an assistive intelligence, I think, is nice. Of course, it all really depends on having a solid, I think, philosophical, moral, ethical base. If we're not taught that, then we don't feel obliged to comply with the guidelines. We don't have that ethical responsibility to the moral and ethics and the pride of authorship. And so I think that that's really important. I wouldn't like to put my name on something that was 99.9% AI because I just wouldn't feel good about myself. And how could I even profit from that?
Yeah, well said.
So I just do want to ask, finally, I really want to see the EU AI Act succeed. And obviously, there'll always be flaws and amendments and things like that. But when you're talking about the global sphere and all aspects of society, it's great to have this Brussels ripple effect. If not all countries are complying or are signing up, we can see sometimes the US flouts international law, the International Criminal Court. We see there's a lot of loopholes that can be created when AI companies are accessible in the EU, but might not be signing up for it. So how do we protect ourselves against this? It's kind of like a sieve. We can, you know, block the holes in our own programs, in our own territories, but it can still affect our populations because people may be sourcing, without realizing it, AI products that originate outside of the EU. And is there a kind of labeling, or is there a kind of something that like, this is possibly not ethically produced AI, or I don't know, how do we inform the public?
Well, I think the obvious answer to me would be that we should collaborate more internationally. So the EU should not just stay within the EU, even though the EU as a market is massive and there's like over 400 million people. And so whatever the EU does matters a lot already from that perspective, because a lot of citizens will be affected by that. But still, there are billions and billions of people all over the world, and the EU should not just be complacent and happy about what they do within the EU. They should collaborate with other countries, speak with others, raise awareness of what the EU AI Act says and what it doesn't. There's a lot of misinformation about the EU AI Act. That's why we have set up this EU AI Act website and we produce the newsletter. We want to inform as many people as possible because from time to time, you hear very false information about the EU and you just want as many to know about it as possible. But yeah, just collaborate more internationally with other countries, see what makes sense for them. I think some level of experimentation in the world is reasonable. Not everybody has to just copy what the EU does without any critical thoughts. Not everything that the EU creates is always positive and good. Some things need to be modified. Hopefully the EU also carries out this experiment, learns from it, changes, updates the law based on some evidence, the actual effectiveness of the measures that it has put forward. Others should also do some of their own experiments and copy things that are meaningful from the EU or other jurisdictions. And I think we should try to converge as much as possible in the world because it also creates more legal certainty for businesses working in the global markets. You don't want every region to have entirely different laws because it's just more challenging for companies to scale the different sides of the world. So whenever possible, we should try to converge, but we can't converge in an unlimited way because there are some differences in values, some differences in culture, some differences in what citizens want. So some level of experimentation, I think, is reasonable.
Yeah, exactly. And regionally, there's values that we need to safeguard. So in closing, as you look towards the future and the importance of having a human-centered AI, the importance of the arts and humanities and human-authored creativity, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Great question. So I think young people definitely have a challenge right now figuring out what to do in the age of AI. I think it's definitely useful for them to experiment with AI, be very knowledgeable about AI. That's definitely very important. I also think that interpersonal skills are just going to become more and more important, even though maybe AI could do many of those types of tasks as well or better. We arguably might make a choice as a society that we don't want to delegate everything to AI. Also, maybe we just prefer certain kinds of things to remain in humans. For example, even though AI could create a really interesting video, maybe we just want other people to be speaking and us listening to those conversations. Like we are having a conversation right now. I'm sure AI could produce these conversations with fewer linguistic mistakes or grammar mistakes. When speaking, maybe you would have access to more interesting facts because you would have super memory and so on. But perhaps some people just enjoy listening to two less than perfect individuals having an interesting conversation and they being part of that and it creating some kind of interesting thoughts in their heads. So I hope that interpersonal conversations, interpersonal skills, kind of meaningful people skills, having abilities to interact in physical spaces with other humans, like that's going to be super relevant in the age of AI. I still think that all of those other things that young people could take a conscious decision that they discipline themselves a little bit and don't immediately go for AI to do those things. So writing, for example, is thinking. Writing itself is a thinking process. It helps you think things through. So maybe put some effort into thinking on paper, using your own handwriting, a physical pen or pencil, and just thinking things through that actually can improve your own skills in many useful ways. And then maybe you can use AI to amplify some of that writing and thinking later. So I would say, yeah, maybe those would be a few takeaways in the age of AI for younger people.
Well, yeah, it's so important. And it's a real holistic vision. You know, we are human beings, even though we are getting so close to our machines and AI, but we have to remember to have that holistic view of ourselves to take care of ourselves. So I think that's hugely important. Well, thank you, Risto Uk, for helping us understand the stakes of artificial intelligence and the choices governments and people are facing. By clarifying the urgency and systemic risks, we can carefully shape how societies respond to this transformative technology and create a better tomorrow. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Creative Process podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Katie Foster and Virginia Moschetti. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anatolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just follow us on Instagram at Creative Process Podcast and send us a DM. Thanks for listening.